Okay. My name is Molly Marin. I am the webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. I'm very pleased to have Dr. Seth Aldrich with us today to present our Strand 15 series. But before we get started, I just have a few reminders. All upcoming professional development offerings are listed on our webpage at nysrti.org. A copy of today's PowerPoint as well as handouts are available on the webpage. If you go under webinars and then today's webinar title, you'll find those. During today's presentation, please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. And at the end of today's presentation, we'll post a link to a brief evaluation. You'll also get that via email right after the presentation. If you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we very much appreciate the feedback. So again, this is our Strand 15 series. This is the first webinar in a five-session strand. The strand title is Integrating Tiered Database Decision-Making to Address Essential Questions in an RTI Process. And today's topic is Overview of Tiered Database Decision-Making. We are very pleased to have Seth Aldrich with us. He is a certified bilingual school psychologist, as well as a New York State licensed psychologist who earned his PhD in psychology at Syracuse University. He works as a school psychologist for the Homer Central School District and also consults with school districts across the U.S. concerning response to intervention for academic and behavioral difficulties. Seth consults with districts to utilize FastBridge Learning as well as AIMSWeb and other RTI assessments as part of a database decision-making within a tiered problem-solving process. He is a consortium member with the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center and works primarily with English as a new language learners, as well as family court-involved youth in his private practice. He is on the editorial review board for School Psychology Quarterly and scientific advisory panel for School Psychology Review. Seth has published several articles in school psychology journals and has presented at many statewide as well as national conferences on topics such as using assessment information to inform instruction and intervention, tiered problem-solving approaches, database decision-making, program evaluation, peer tutoring, school-based intervention teams, and RTI for English language learners. And at this time, it is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Seth Aldrich.
Thanks a lot, Molly. Hi, everybody. As you know, this will be the first of five sessions, and this first session is the really overview of tiered database decision making, and it's really especially this first session is about creating a hierarchy and an infrastructure for how we make decisions to answer the important questions that we have in schools. Could we get a poll for who all you are? I'd like to get an idea about the folks participating today. The roles that you have, the grades that you have. Don't be shy. See some people typing in the chat. I don't know if some of the polls are, hopefully they're pretty intuitive on how to use. Thanks for typing in the chat there. That helps too. You see some math, looks like a pretty good diverse grade range. I do really appreciate folks weighing in on the polls. It helps me to kind of understand where you all are and helps me to shape some of the further sessions that we'll have. I do need to, one of those full disclosure things, as Molly was saying, I do do some training for FastBridge, so it's one of those full disclosure things. But this is not a FastBridge presentation. I will try to integrate this information with some of the assessments that you all are actually using and really trying to map it onto those tools that are out there for you all. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and progress away from the polls and take a look at some of the things that we'll cover today. Developing an infrastructure to support tiered decision-making. And again, today's presentation is really about that infrastructure. If the infrastructure and the groundwork is laid, it really makes RTI response to intervention and multi-tiered system of supports much easier because you're really not having to react to problems. You really have everything scheduled in. Things are integrated. There's support from the ground up and the top down. So what is it about the kind of, what are the decisions that we have to make in schools? Really we'll focus on the essential questions and really focus on what are the questions that educators have to answer to support students. RTI assessments that really can be used for multiple purposes to address multiple questions and how to use them effectively. In order to do that, we have to understand the characteristics and qualities of those RTI assessments. And who are the important players? Who is the audience for the assessments? How can we use assessments in a way that they're integrated and address multiple questions so that I know that there's a lot of concern among educators that we take too much time out of the classroom for assessment. I totally agree with that. And if we have a really efficient, integrated model, then it will take a lot less time to do, then we'll work efficiently. It's really about planning, coordinating, communicating, and responding. And so we really need to have a good data management in order to do that. You've probably seen what we call the dreaded triangle. I think we've become a little bit tired maybe of the acronym RTI. You'll see in a lot of states they're going towards MTSS or multi-tiered system of supports. We look at academic on one side, behavioral on the other. We understand that you really, for many students, we have to address both sides. And I say behavioral, but it's really social, emotional, and behavioral. I'm not going to go through this entire slide. It's more to present that what some of the characteristics of Tier 3 are on both sides, social, emotional, behavioral, and academic. I see some of you are math teachers. Some of the examples will be a little bit literacy-centric. I really will try to address math as well. But as you know, RTI in New York State is mandated K through 4 for literacy. I definitely want to talk about how we generalize some of those procedures and that infrastructure to math folks as well. I see some folks are 5 through 8. We have an initiative where we're looking at middle school RTI, and I'll try to talk about some concepts that are important for middle schools as they proceed into RTI. So we got Tier 3, of course. We call this intensive care, students who are at risk for lifelong difficulties. Tier 2, maybe some triage, maybe long-term, maybe short-term. And, of course, Tier 1 is everyone. And what kind of supports do we need to give all students? And that has to do with the interventions that we're providing, the differentiated core instruction that we provide to everybody. I just want to make sure, Molly, can you see my arrow on this slide? Did I move my arrow around? No. Okay, thank you, Molly. There we go. I think if I do this, now you can, right? There we go. I see it now. Thank you, Molly. We'll talk about just, again, infrastructure to support the tiered models. What I'm going to talk about, because you've probably seen the triangle for assessment and for intervention, I'm really going to focus on how we can do tiered problem solving. And in tiered problem solving, we have, for everybody, Tier 1, we have informal discussion with colleagues. That happens with everybody. Talk about with your colleagues who may have had a student last year. There's a lot of informal discussion where we're supporting one another in schools. It tends to be pretty informal. We're going to talk about an infrastructure that looks at post-benchmark data meetings. That's where we take the universal screenings that are a part of our RTI process and discuss the data three times a year after the benchmark occurs, we want a forum where we can really discuss that data really talk about what that data means. And we're going to really talk about what important questions we need to address at that post-benchmark data meeting. And one of the most important things that we address is tier one. How is everybody doing? So we'll talk about what those questions are. Then, and there are all sorts of ways that we would do this, progress monitor checkup meetings. And that is where in between those post-benchmark, the benchmarks, of course, that occur September, perhaps January, and May is a typical schedule. But then in between, we're having some formal evaluation of the progress monitoring data, typically for kids receiving Tier 2 and Tier 3 supports. But that's where we're really looking at some of the progress monitoring data and then responding to that data for students. And then we also have individualized problem-solving meetings where we really we might have some students with complex problems where these kind of grade-level meetings or where we're really looking at the entire grade level or maybe students getting tiered supports as a group, some kids we really need to talk about individually. Over here, we might, and these, again, are typically students receiving Tier 2 and Tier 3 supports. It doesn't mean that we wouldn't have a student who academically is doing quite well, but we still need to do an individualized meeting for that student. I'll talk about that. We'll talk more about this in the fourth webinar that I'll be doing. Some students are going to need some multidisciplinary team meeting. I call CSC planning, or students with IEPs where we're doing IEP planning, referrals for CSC, annual reviews, reevaluation meetings, those kinds of things. That's a problem-solving meeting. But it's kind of the nature of that meeting is somewhat different. And the questions that we ask are different for those. I call them MDT meetings. Of course, they go by all sorts of names. Then another tier that we have is the school and the district decision-making. And this is for all tiers. But many times, say we go to a post-benchmark meeting and we identify an area in Tier 1 that is really quite problematic that we need to address, we might need to take that to a district or school decision-making process. And so we're going to talk about all these tiers and how if we coordinate efforts and really have these systems built in as an infrastructure, it's going to make our RTI process work much better. And so we've got all these initiatives. We've got Common Core, RTI/MTSS. Again, they're kind of synonymous. PBIS, AIS, school improvement, special ed, local assistance plans. And sometimes we have separate committees that address all of these things without really being coordinated. And at the end of the day, they all involve effective instruction, effective interventions, database decision-making, smart use of resources, and coordinated efforts. So if we really have a tiered problem-solving process with a good infrastructure, we'll really work smart and coordinate all these efforts. Now, the point is we don't want to work in silos. And oftentimes we are. We work in silos, and some of these efforts that we have, some of them mandated, unfunded mandates, that need to be coordinated so that we're not recreating the wheel every time we're sitting in a committee meeting. Okay, you know, and we've already kind of talked about this slide where, there should be a synergy across all these different kind of problem-solving mechanisms that we have in a school. So the first mechanism or form that we're going to talk about are these post-benchmark data meetings. We're really going to go into detail about post-benchmark data meetings next week at the May 10th webinar. We'll talk about progress monitoring the following week, effective problem-solving teams for individual students the following week, and then more of a school or the school and district team problem-solving the following week. So those will be the five strands. So I really hope that you attend all five. We have to get down to what are the main questions? You know, sometimes people say, well, we do this assessment for screening. We do this assessment for problem or for progress monitoring. Or we need formative evaluation assessments. And I kind of like to take a step back and really focus on, well, truly, what are the questions that we have to answer? And having done a lot of assessment presentations, when I've asked lots and lots of teachers about what are the questions that are important to you as an educator, what questions do you need to answer to help your students? When I've done this kind of in kind of a polling format, I've always been not surprised, but this is almost always the first answer teachers give us. I need to know what students know, what are their needs, and what do I need to teach students? I need data and assessments to tell me that. The second one typically that teachers will tell me is, well, I need to know, is an individual student making progress? Are they, is all the hard work that I'm doing making some gains for the student? Do I stay the course, or do I need to make an instructional adjustment? And so that would be your progress monitoring. Teachers and educators are quite aware of program evaluation needs. Are the programs and practices in our school effective? This might be, is our core effective? It might be, is this intervention that we're using for a certain segment of students kind of an expensive intervention? Is this really working for kids? Are there subgroups of students that are we meeting the needs of certain subgroups of students? So are programs and practices in school effective in meeting students' needs? And finally, kind of at a district level, you know, how do we improve our educational system for all students? We need to address things like, okay, what materials are we lacking in? What resources do we need? Are there scheduling conflicts that we need to address? Are there professional development efforts? Our data can inform all of these questions, and that infrastructure that I was talking about can be extremely helpful in addressing these very important questions for students. So taking kind of a look at that universal screening, one of the core components of RTI is that we do universal screening three times a year, synonymous with benchmark assessments. And there are several qualities that these assessments really need to have. They need to be, because we do use them for some relatively high-stakes assessments or decision-making, we want those assessments to be reliable and valid, that they have some psychometric adequacy so that, you know, we give it one day, we don't get a completely different answer the next day, or that two different people looking at the student performance will get about the same answer about how they did. And it needs to answer important questions. We want assessments for RTI to be efficient. It has to be feasible, easily trained, that the logistics of administration, you know, it doesn't require a lot of training or a lot of time. It has to measure important skills that are important for learning. We often look at these assessments as being predictive of student risk. And when we get to some of the questions that we're answering, that we answered during that post-benchmark meeting, we really begin to look at this. We want assessments, and it's kind of funny because one of the assessments that we use for universal screening being curriculum-based measures, we used to use curriculum-based measures right from the curriculum, and now we really focus on, we want a measure that's really kind of independent of the curriculum. So no matter what the intervention is, we should see growth in a general outcome measure. We need the assessments to be communicated. I keep using my arrow on my computer, not the green one. We need assessments that can be communicated with a variety of audiences for a variety of purposes. We need assessments that are culturally and linguistically fair. Again, not to just read through these slides, but I do want to kind of point out some of these important qualities. And as we get through, we'll see what the questions that are addressed through the universal, the post-benchmark meetings, where we'll identify proportions of students at risk, and is that risk decreasing? So that's an important assessment purpose that we do with our universal screenings. A lot of the purpose of our universal screenings and our post-benchmark meeting is to really do program evaluation. We want to see our underserved populations. Are we meeting the needs of those students? We need to look at, is our core instruction effective? We can't really meet the needs of students through tiered interventions if our core instruction is not effective. So we'll be addressing this in just a little bit. Knowing whether our risk among our student population is increasing or decreasing, prioritizing students for tiered intervention based on resources that are existing in the school. We'll be talking about this in just a second. Guiding student instruction. Hopefully we've got information both from the universal screening and from other diagnostic assessments that we'll talk about, especially next week, that help us to guide student instruction. And our universal screenings also help us to establish a baseline for progress monitoring. And many times what you see is we've got computer adaptive tests that we'll talk about in just a second, and curriculum-based measures. Some schools use both. Some schools use one or the other. Some you might use a curriculum-based assessment in K through 2 or 3, and then computer adaptive tests for other grades. And so we're going to take a look. I want to ask you right now with a poll, if you would please let me know what RTI universal screenings you use in your district. This will be really helpful information for me as I try to structure some of the future presentations to make them relevant to you. So if you would just take a minute, there's two polls. One is for RTI universal screening in your school, and the other is for RTI progress monitoring in your school. This will be really helpful for me, to structure the presentation. I'll give a few minutes for people to weigh in on this. All right, so I'm seeing predominantly STAR, AIMS-Web. That's kind of what I predicted. And some of the slides that you'll see in this presentation and other presentations will include STAR and AIMS-Web. I see districts using DIBELS, iReady for progress monitoring in one district, Fontes and Pinnell for universal screening and progress monitoring in one or two places, district-created measures, other. Easy CBM, I see somebody listing here. Thank you. And then none. Thank you. We're going to kind of progress through this. Hopefully, some of my examples are going to make sense for you. Okay. Thank you, Molly. I do want to talk just a little bit about, because some of the assessments that you listed, for example, I've got just a slide here, some tools that are frequently used for universal screening in literacy. You've got AIMS-Web. AIMS-Web is a CBM. It does have math. It does have behavior. But it's not a computer adaptive test. STAR is a computer adaptive test. By computer adaptive, students get on the computer. They would initially start with grade level items. For those of you who aren't familiar with computer adaptive tests, based on the student's response, it will give them more difficult items if they're getting items correct, and easier items if they're getting several items incorrect. That's a computer adaptive test. What's nice about them, and I've got some kind of qualities of computer adaptive tests and curriculum-based measures that I'll go into, but they're vertically scaled. So a STAR, you can have kindergarten through 12th grade. Same with FastBridge, which is a computer adaptive test. iReady, computer adaptive test. NWEA, these are all computer adaptive tests. Then you've got CBM measures like AIMS-Web, DIBELS. Somebody said Easy CBM would be a CBM measure. These measures would be more a fluency measure, 1-minute oral reading fluency, or letter sounds correct per minute, or, and for math, it might be a math computation probe that the student spends, say, 8 to 10 minutes on, and how many points they get in a minute would be for AIMSWeb. So we've got these tools, some of which are computer adaptive tests or CBM. FastBridge is kind of interesting because it provides both. Some provide do reading. Some include math. In fact, all of these listed provide math assessments. Some provide behavioral assessments, and others don't. What is sometimes really helpful is where we have the same tool for both universal screening and progress monitoring, that we're not having to purchase two different tools, understand, you know, how to navigate two different tools. Sometimes when we've got one tool that does everything, that tends to be very helpful. With computer adaptive tests, they're a really good measure of broad skills because many times they're able to assess directly comprehension, vocabulary, phonics, phonemic awareness, concepts of print, those kinds of things. They're very effective at predicting risk. They are really good at looking at applied skills. And they're very feasible. One of the attractive things about computer adaptive tests is you can put all the kids in your class in a computer lab, and 20 minutes later, you have your assessment results. Very little training for staff to do these computer adaptive tests. Very feasible in that respect. With curriculum, now one of the downsides of computer adaptive tests, it might take 15 to 60 minutes to conduct an assessment, and they're a bit less sensitive to improvement by and large. So for progress monitoring, they can be kind of problematic. Curriculum-based assessments, on the other hand, curriculum-based measures have certain qualities. They're very good assessments of specific skills or reading fluency. You can see the specific skills, the letters that students were able to say the sounds of in a minute. Whereas typically in your computer adaptive test, you do not see the item bank. You get a standard score that reflects what a student may have mastered and may be working on, but you don't see the specific skills that the student demonstrated during that assessment. With curriculum-based measures, you can really see what they did. You can do an error analysis of what they did. Sometimes because it's only a minute, it may be somewhat lacking in terms of guiding instruction. They're good predictors of risk, especially K-4 for universal screening, and for higher grade levels for progress monitoring. Say you have an eighth grader who's reading on a second grade level. They're really good, sensitive to improvement measures for monitoring progress. They're very brief, so you can do them weekly without taking a lot of time out of the student's instruction. But they do require some training, and most CBMs are one-to-one assessments. So again, you see real strengths of both of these. Computer adaptive tests are probably a stronger measure, especially for universal screening grades 4 and up. For a lot of students who are kindergartners, we may want to do a one-on-one assessment with them rather than putting them in front of a computer in the kindergarten level. So CBMs don't really directly measure constructs like comprehension and vocabulary. So as you can see, there are strengths and weaknesses to both of these kinds of universal screening measures. And I'm not going to go through this slide a lot. You can refer back to this slide if you wanted to view the webinar later. But what I did was I took some of the tools that folks use. Are they recommended for universal screening, for reading, for math? Are they recommended for progress monitoring, the time needed for the assessment? Are they recommended for progress monitoring for math? What's the time needed for that assessment? Just so that you can get kind of a look at your toolkit and what might really fit in that toolkit. Does it assess social emotional behavioral concerns? Can it be used for New York State APPR? That's kind of a moot point, I think, until 2019. Are they a computer adaptive test or a CBM? Does the data guide instruction? This can sometimes be somewhat of a subjective response, depending on how people use the tool and their comfort level with it, what they take out of it, how they use it. And does it provide some tools like iReady are kind of cool because they take the assessment data and they really map it onto a recommended intervention. So this slide can be used if you wanted to refer to it back through the downloaded webinar, but it's kind of big for me to cover it in the time that we have remained. There's a really good webinar that Kay Stahl did recently on conducting your assessment inventory, making sure that your assessment toolkit in your school is really solid. I did this a little bit different from Kay's, but you might look at your assessment domain of reading, math, written expression, social, emotional, behavioral, and then those different questions that I had posted. You know, identifying instructional needs to guide instruction. What assessments in reading do we have that are really geared to do that? Well, how about monitoring progress of individual students? For this, because of the nature of RTI, and, you know, we'll talk about this more on the fifth webinar about district-level decisions about how we might be using the RTI process to identify students for disability, we want to make sure that we've got progress monitoring that is pretty high stakes. So when we look at assessment qualities, we might really want to have a reliable, valid progress monitoring tool. So when you're considering certain purposes for the assessment, you've got to be looking at assessment qualities that include reliability and validity, feasibility, especially if you're doing weekly progress monitoring, multiple equated forms, are they sensitive to improvement? Do they measure important things? Are they organized and communicated effectively, and are they culturally and linguistically fair? So as you go through and kind of fill in these blanks on what assessments you use for these different purposes, be thinking about the assessment qualities that are important for each purpose. We need assessments, again, our universal screenings we typically use to prioritize for multi-tiered support, where we're going up the list and looking at student risk levels. We need assessments that evaluate programs and practices, looking at our core instruction. If we've got a fairly large pool of risk in our student population at a given grade or in a given class, are we reducing risk in that population? What assessments do we use for special education identification? We really need something in our toolkit for that. And for RTI, we do use that process as part of a comprehensive evaluation for learning disabilities. As you may know, the RTI guidance document that's available on the TAC website provides some guidance for doing that. We need assessments for IEP goals, and we have assessments for accountability. So just making sure that your toolkit doesn't have redundancies where we've got tons of assessment for one thing, but then we don't have anything. Say we have a lot of assessments to guide instruction, but nothing for that progress monitoring that we want to do. So look for gaps and redundancies in your assessment inventory. So getting down to our universal screening, and again, we're going to talk about the post-benchmark screening meetings, what the steps are to these meetings, what important questions we want to answer, what graphs might be really useful during these post-benchmark meetings, again, September, January, May, or June. These should really be built into your calendar at the beginning of the year. So you really make sure that those meetings happen. They're just sort of not afterthoughts. And again, we'll talk about really in-depth steps to these meetings next week. In between the post-benchmark meetings, we want to have some different meetings to really talk about progress monitoring checkups, where we're formally reviewing the data. And that would be in between September and January. Some people, you know, want to have weekly meetings. I'm not sure that that's necessary. I'd probably want to be talking about more about instruction, maybe in between. But periodically, really looking at those progress monitoring, the progress monitoring data that we have. And we'll talk about some forums for doing that. Post-benchmark data, when did they happen? After the fall, winter, and spring administration of the universal screening. One thing they'll talk about next week is the unique characteristics that we have for the fall benchmark. There are certain questions we answer in the fall that we really don't in the winter and spring so much. Things that we do in the winter that we don't do in the fall, and there are questions specific to spring universal screenings that we want to take a look at. So I'll be talking about that next week. The members, I really strongly encourage that you have these meetings at a grade level because a lot of what you're doing at the post-benchmark meeting is about resource allocation, coming up with groups, really using resources, your interventionists, your materials, really getting everybody on a level playing field and using your resources in a really effective way. And the first thing that you look at is your core effective? Having the whole grade level there to kind of look at that data and see what you can do, not just for the struggling learners, but for your entire grade level. So you really want to have the grade level teachers there. You want to have interventionists at that grade level. A school administrator is extremely helpful because you might be really identifying some really important issues at that meeting that a school administrator needs to hear. And again, we're going to go more a lot more into the specifics of these meetings next week, but this is really just to talk about that infrastructure overall. School psychologists and other support staff can be really helpful to have there because they might interpret data. They might have some knowledge about interventions and assessments can be really helpful. Certainly speech-language folks. Yeah, everybody's really different in who they might have at that grade-level team meeting. And the purpose of that meeting is to look at grade-level needs. So the first thing we look at is core instruction. It's program evaluation, really addressing the students of many students through a timely, coordinated process. It's really kind of a triage meeting. Again, we'll talk a lot more in depth about this next week. Assigning students to tiered targeted interventions, really beginning to plan your progress monitoring logistics, and then prioritizing students who require another meeting. We always say at a grade level meeting, if we talk about a student for more than, you know, 1 or 2 minutes, we really may need to go to an individual problem solving meeting. There's a lot of preparation that we have before we go into this post-benchmark data meeting. We really want to have a menu of multiple interventions at each tier. And I have one of the resources, in addition to the assessment inventory that I just showed you, this, and I'm going to forward the slide for just a second, it looks like this. It's an intervention menu that you can use to really, before the meeting, you want to know what you have to offer kids. Where you're not having to kind of think that up at the grade level meeting where you're all sitting around the table. Having that menu of multiple interventions at each tier to address students' needs can be really, really helpful so that you can really hit the ground running at the meeting and know what you have to offer kids. We really can't depend on one intervention program. There's no intervention program that fits the needs of all students. We'll talk a lot about this when we get into the third webinar session on progress monitoring. And again, I keep on using my mouse arrow and not the green arrow here. One of the things that we want to do is have that integration of the school and district RTI team to inform the grade level team and the grade level team to inform the school and the district team, because it's really about the coordination. And there's some things that I'll show you that are important for the district team to have kind of thought about that's going to inform how the grade level team works. Okay. And again, I showed you this menu. This should be a live document. It's a table form that you can download off of the RTI TAC site under this webinar for today. It's a resource that you can download. You want to have the intervention name. You want the grades used in your school. Maybe it's designed for K-4, but you happen to use it in K-1. What the skills are addressed. Think of the big five ideas: phonics, phonemic awareness, fluency, vocabulary comprehension. In the actual download that I have, you've got, okay, we've got this for Tier 1 strategies, another table for Tier 2, another table for Tier 3. If you've got a lot of English language learners in your school, you might want to do these separate for what you do for your English language learners. You might have some specific interventions used for them. What are some of the needed supports? I find that when we talk about interventions in the different schools that I work, you'll hear things like, yeah, I think we've got that kit, but we've got to order some more blank. Or we've got these kits, but we really haven't had the training yet. We need some more training to really pull this off. So you really could be filling out this live document of a table to say, well, we've got this great intervention, but these are some things that we really are lacking right now to pull it off. How much time per day is needed? This is a huge consideration. Some interventions that you'll see on What Works Clearinghouse or other kind of clearinghouses of intervention, some of these interventions might take 2 minutes. Others might take 90 minutes. You really have to know what time has to be devoted in order to pull that intervention off, how many days a week are required to pull it off effectively as the intervention was designed. What the group size is, this will tell you, is it more like a tier 2 intervention, 5-to-1, or could it be used as a tier 3 intervention, more like 3-to-1 or even more intensive? And then how fidelity is, instead of maybe assessed, I might say supported, what do we do to support teachers who are using this intervention? Do we have a literacy coach that might be going in and helping teachers to make sure that they're doing this intervention? Maybe some of these interventions are kind of complex, they're new. How are we going to support teachers to use that intervention effectively? Okay, so that intervention menu can be very, very helpful. All right, so your task one, and again, we're going to go into this much more in depth next week, but I did kind of put up some of the various graphs that we use for task one of that grade level meeting. How effective is the grade level at addressing needs of all students? Well, I've got my arrow here on AIMSWeb, and in this AIMSWeb, you may or may not be familiar with these reports. Again, I did want to map this presentation onto some of the specific graphs that tools like AIMSWeb and STAR that you're using. I did bring in some FastBridge reports, but I did want to kind of illustrate how some of these charts that you might use with your measures really work to address those specific questions. So how effective is the grade level at addressing needs of all students? When I look at fall here, in a typical school, 15% would be high risk. High risk for AIMSWeb is 15th percentile nationally and below typically. That's about the cutoff for them. In this grade level, in the fall, there are 47%. Say, oh my gosh. Now, this is not, and we have to be really careful about making assumptions, this isn't on this grade level's what their effective practices. This is on students from the year before. They're coming. This is what this grade level is inheriting. They're inheriting about 50% of the kids at high risk. Only 29% are at low risk. Typically, measures in green, and this is actually somewhat universal. AIMSWeb and STAR typically look at about the 40th or 45th percentile to be deemed low risk. As well as FastBridge for that matter. This would be kind of a low risk category. Some people would say tier one. Some people would say, well, we need to put 33% of our kids into tier two, some risk between the 45th and 15th percentile. And these students, we've got to put into tier three. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense because very, very few schools would have the resources to be able to provide this many, to provide intervention supports for this many students. So it's really, really important that we kind of look at this and prioritize students. And in this case, we need to support the core instruction. We have to support many, many more students than we would be able to accommodate in tier two and tier three. But now we look at from fall to winter, and we see, oh my gosh, now this kind of is on this grade level. This is not exactly a happy story here, where we see increasing risk from fall to winter, and then from winter to spring, we see some decreasing risk, but the grade level, this isn't about putting a few kids into tiered intervention. This is really where we really have to work on our core. And it's not going to be just about involving the grade level. They're going to need some school and district support when we've got this many kids at risk. And so we've got reports, like I just kind of did an illustration of AIMS. Again, we'll talk about these kinds of reports a lot more in depth next week. STAR would have similar reports, color-coded, same kind of colors. Typically, high risk is red, some risk being yellow. And then they've got various risk categories. And you've got some risk categories that you can look at over different years with STAR. And the same with FastBridge. So these are charts. After we look at the core instruction, because we're really looking at program evaluation here, and what do we need to do to having a discussion about what are some areas of weakness in our core? What can we do to support core? What resources do we need? How can we work together to do that? And then after the step two in our universal screening meeting, we would want to prioritize students for intervention. Typically, we kind of work up the list. We often will use local norms for this because that's sort of our, we can, again, we only have enough resources for a certain amount of students at tier three and tier two, and then some students might need have supports at tier in tier one. And we've got different reports that do kind of the similar kind of thing, color-coded, AIMSWeb, FastBridge. FastBridge has, where this really has only one comparison, you might be comparing students to national norms here, and then you click expand, and then you compare them to district norms, and then you click expand, and then you have to look at students at the grade level in a particular school with AIMSWeb. With FastBridge, you've got national, district, school, and classroom kind of risk comparisons all on one page, also with criteria and cut scores. And same thing with STAR. With STAR, you've got various reports that look at students here, and the student names are down here, where you can prioritize your students for intervention. We not only do we look at who's going to be prioritized for tiered supports, and again, typically we're looking at a certain number depending on the resources that we have to get into tier three, students that we prioritize for tier two. But once you've got those students into tiered supports, we still might have students that didn't get into those tiered supports who are still at risk. We typically look at low risk corresponding, whether it's STAR, AIMSWeb, or FastBridge. Typically, criterion cut scores are set to be about 40th to 45th percentile. Once you're above the 45th percentile nationally, you typically, when they've done correlations with a typical state test, you've got at least an 80% chance of passing that state test. But having, not just relying on your local norms, you want to have a reality check to say, well, yeah, in fact, on this graph, compared to the classroom and the grade level, these kids are average. But if I went to another school, typical school across the country, again, I'm using my mouse arrow. So these kids would be average compared to the class level and the grade level. But then when I look over here, they're considered high risk compared to the national norm. So again, this is a national norm column and a school norm column. You have to be very, this is sort of your reality check of where they would be in a typical school across the country. So we wouldn't want to say that this student here is low risk. We would want to say, well, they're not prioritized. They're going to have to be addressed in tier one in this particular school. So what do they need? The other task that we have to do is it's not just about grouping students in tiered interventions according to their prioritized risk. We also want to look at what are their needs. STAR has reports that kind of, that they, based on the standard score, they might consider, well, these are some suggested skills, things that maybe they've mastered, things that they might be working on, and they give some recommendations for some skills that might be introduced into the intervention. With AIMSWeb and early literacy, you might say, well, they've got, this student is high risk in letter names, some risk in letter sounds, high risk in these areas. And you can kind of look at risk according to some different skills, letter naming fluency, letter sound, phoneme segmentation, nonsense word. And see, for example, this student, pretty strong across the board for most measures, but we might want to help the student with some phoneme segmentation in Tier 1. So, and again, we'll talk about this a lot more next week, but we need, the universal screenings might be used to do some diagnostic assessments. Clearly, we need more than just our universal screenings to understand students' needs. So we need some diagnostic assessments. This is where our school and district teams can kind of inform the grade level team. We have some criteria for what low risk in our school would be. It might be students who are meeting or exceeding the criterion reference cut score. Students that are at slight risk, they're above the 30th percentile nationally, but below the cut score. Again, this is up to the school or district to determine these risk categories, some risk categories, and high risk categories. So your school and district team helps to determine who are students in our district at this particular grade level that would be included for tiered supports. So what guides decision making? It's really about your available resources. I would be really careful about saying, you know, anybody who is below the 15th percentile nationally is going to get Tier 3, because as we know, from year to year, student populations change. The needs at a various at a given grade level change. We need to, a lot of times when we sit down at the grade level table, we really need to know what resources are available, how many staff are available to provide intervention groups, what resources are available for those staff to provide. Having that intervention menu can be really helpful for that. Decision rules that kind of guide our process. We don't want to be too rigid about those decision rules. They should guide our, I always say, we want to be guided by data, not handcuffed by it. So having those decision rules kind of help to guide the process. But we also want to be really thoughtful about that. And then what I find is sometimes when we're working up the list, let's see if I've got a chart here. I know. So if we're working up a list on one of these charts and we've got students where we're kind of saying, well, these kids are definitely going to get Tier 3. And then we kind of work up the list. Well, we may have resources for Tier 3 here. How about Tier 2 for these students? This student here should be in Tier 2, and he'd be in a good group with her because they have some of the same instructional needs. So we don't necessarily group based on intensity. We also need to group according to need. When we're looking at guiding our decision-making, we really have creative ideas across the grade level to try to stretch our resources to address the needs of as many students as we can at that data meeting. And, of course, it's really important. I've certainly learned over time that I think there are things that I would never forget at a meeting. Sometimes I've learned to take copious notes. Having tables like this, student name, what are the needs that were identified for that student? What are the interventions that we're going to provide for that student? What are any barriers that we have to providing that intervention that we have to do before we're going to be able to pull that off? And what's the progress monitoring tool? So we begin to set up progress monitoring logistics. Then we might need to, so this would be students identified for Tier 3. Students identified for Tier 2 intervention supports. You might have a table for that as well. So having some good information collection devices so that you come back after the meeting and you've got all your ducks in a row, all your information that you need on students organized really effectively. And then you might have a step in your meeting. Again, I've been a little bit literacy-centric, although the same graphs that I showed you could be applied for math skills. You go through and you talk about tiered math supports. And then you might have screenings. FastBridge has Sabres, AIMSWeb has the BESS or the SSIS. It's a screening tool for social, emotional, and behavioral issues. And schools without these kinds of things, we might sometimes just say, okay, let's identify some students that we need to talk about later, just with the principal, teacher, school psychologist, social worker, in a more private meeting, about what some things we can do to assure that they're having their social, emotional, and behavioral needs met. So we might just work up the list. At a grade level meeting, sometimes we're very discreet about those kinds of supports. But it's definitely an important thing to talk about. Now we talk about qualities of progress monitoring. Just for the sake of time, this slide has some of those qualities that are very important for progress monitoring, like sensitive to progress, multiple equated forms, general outcome measures. And the reason I bring this up is there's some progress monitoring tools that are embedded in a particular intervention. And there's some problems with that because what happens is students show growth in that specific intervention, but then they don't generalize those skills to other things. We want progress monitoring to measure important things. They have to monitor what's being instructed, sensitive to what the intervention is. They have to be easy to administer consistently and brief, feasible for weekly data collection. Progress monitoring for Tier 2 and Tier 3 should happen weekly. And we should have goals. We should know what it means, and it should be meaningful when a student hits a certain goal. We should know what that means. It should be understandable. So at our checkup data meetings, we're really focusing more on the progress monitoring data. These meetings would happen in between our post-benchmark meetings. Sometimes schools use collegial circles. Others might have a meeting in, say, November, beginning of November, or in March, about, give the interventions that we planned in our September meeting about 8 or 9 weeks to take hold, and then we have a meeting, formal meeting, to evaluate the progress monitor at a grade level so that we can shuffle up groups or make some of those intervention changes as necessary. It's really helpful to have everybody there at the meeting so that we can kind of reshuffle, reorganize in a thoughtful and coordinated effort. And so you might have another one in March. So it might be 6 to 8 weeks after the universal screening administration where everybody sits down and takes a look at the data. It might be collegial circles, grade level team meetings, meetings with instructional coaches, et cetera. And schools do this really differently. Certainly, I prefer to have the whole grade level there because you can really talk about scheduling, reshuffling students so that the interventions are more targeted. Sometimes we don't understand all of the needs at the fall benchmark. You have better data, say, by November about what students need. And so that reshuffling can be really helpful. Administrators can be really helpful to give permission for some of these changes, but having all the colleagues there to kind of look at everybody else's data and needs, and there's a real teamwork process that's built in with this. And again, the focus is typically on students receiving Tier 2 and Tier 3 supports, and including some recent diagnostic data that had been collected so that not only are interventions based on the intensity of need, but on the targeted need for the student. So at these kinds of meetings, and this would be a mid-benchmark as well as your winter post-benchmark meeting, who's making progress? Don't forget to celebrate these kids that are making the improvement. We don't want to focus on just the bad news. But who needs a core instruction or intervention change? So students that aren't making progress, we can be responsive to that data and provide them with something more intensive or more targeted. We have to really determine what their needs are. And many times by November, January, we really have a better idea of, well, let's these kids would really work better together because they've got similar needs or they have similar intense grade level instructional needs. And for those, we want to discuss strategies, intervention supports, and document those changes. And then also consider things like behavior, attendance, things that over which we have control. We'll talk about those, and students that might need an individual meeting. I see we're kind of getting close to our time. Are there student groups that have similar needs? So we put those students into groups. Plan and document intervention changes and talk about students that might need another meeting, like an individual problem-solving meeting or a multidisciplinary team meeting, possibly a special ed referral, something like that. Maybe it's a parent meeting, a parent with the counselors, et cetera. So we want to have effective problem-solving teams, and those teams we'll be talking about, again, it would be the fourth webinar. We'll go through the steps of problem-solving at that meeting, and we talk about having these individual problem-solving meetings when the problem is multidimensional. You're going to spend more than 2 minutes talking about that student at a grade-level meeting. You really need to have, really look under the hood and really try to understand that student's needs. We might want to have an individual problem-solving team meeting when a student isn't responding to those tier two and tier three interventions, and we're just kind of beside ourselves because we just can't figure out what the student needs. So we want to get our heads together to try to problem-solve for that student. Anytime a student is suspected of having a disability, we want to have an individual meeting to talk about that student's needs and figure out what to do. And it would be, those meetings would be scheduled as needed. Typically the student teachers, the interventionist, school psychologist, school administrator, other staff that would be pertinent to the needs of that student. And what the responsibilities are outlined here. We'll have some referral forms and some documentation forms that help to keep on a really clear problem-solving agenda that will be presented at the webinar for individual problem-solving team meetings. Then we've got multidisciplinary team meetings, really more special ed meetings where we talk about initial reviews, reevaluation reviews, annual reviews, setting IEP goals. But these are the CSE planning and decision-making meetings, really apart from kind of the RTI process, although the RTI process definitely informs these kinds of things, and we can oftentimes use our RTI assessments for things like setting IEP goals and certainly to look at initial referrals. And we'll talk about this more at our fifth webinar. There's an RTI checklist that you'll have available to make sure that you've kind of done all the due diligence in RTI if you're using RTI to build a case for or against a disability. We'll talk about what a dual discrepancy means, which in the literature we talk about for using RTI to build a case. And these multidisciplinary meetings, as you know, we have got annual reviews, reevaluation reviews, and so we might have a different membership, principal, special education director, the special education staff, support staff, school psychologist, speech language, OT, social worker, et cetera. And it's really about making special education decision-making process. The RTI is really designed to try to make sure that our referrals and our designation process is a really appropriate and timely one. And here's a quote from about learning disability determination for New York State, where data from RTI can help to document the reason for students' poor performance and underachievement, and RTI data can yield important descriptive information about how children learn and why they may be having difficulties. And we really need to have an RTI process in place in order for that special ed referral to go forward. But there's a lot that the state has kind of left out in terms of specificity and how learning disabilities are diagnosed. So we'll talk at the fifth webinar on how you can build district you know, some considerations for building your district decision-making around those things. And then we've got the district and school level RTIT meetings, where we really are looking, again, at infrastructure, where we have supports for core instruction, scheduling, looking at acquiring intervention resources and staffing. What are the assessments? Do we have gaps in our assessments for universal screening, progress monitoring, and diagnostics? Is there something that the district needs to purchase at a given grade level or across the grade levels because we've got some gaps? Do we have redundancies where we're taking way too much time with assessments where we can work more efficiently? The school and our district team can really work to make these efforts more coordinated. You get some real decision makers at that meeting. And what your database decision-making infrastructure is, so supporting those. You know, sometimes at a grade level meeting, we hire subs so that the teachers can sit there at that around that table for a couple of hours and really get their ducks in a row about those student supports. And the grade level team and what happens as we're looking at our data, that should be informing our sustained professional development. When we're looking at gaps in our resources, gaps in our assessments, we need some sustained professional development in order to improve that infrastructure. And that's what our school and district support is essential. In fact, when at our RTI TACT and our grant where we looked at K-4, that administrative support we found was just key. Where we did not have administrative support in schools that were involved in the grant, RTI was very, very difficult to pull off. The administrative support where we're looking at all these things is key. We have a lot of hardworking teachers, but they might not have support or infrastructure to pull off all these things that we need to do for RTI. And then we've got some team members for that. Again, for the sake of time, I'm going to kind of go through fairly quickly on this. We'll be talking about school-level data-based decision-making next week and as well as the last webinar. So what percentage of students are at risk? Is risk diminishing? Are there areas that we really need to beef up in our core instruction, or are there interventions that we need to be providing at different tiers to support students? Are there subgroups? Our English language learners, students with disabilities, certain grade levels that really need prioritized supports. Where are the gaps? So our school level database decision making team can really help to support teachers with that infrastructure. And then our district team is informed by the school team, and they may kind of look at more district level support at those things that I just mentioned. I know I went through these last slides fairly quickly, but again, that is going to be the purpose of the fifth webinar in the series, where we work on more of the district infrastructure, including some of the decision-making processes for special education disability decision-making, et cetera. At this time, however, it's 5:07. And I certainly want to reserve some time for some questions that you might have. I'd really appreciate any questions or comments if you would just do that through the chat box. You know, kind of while you're doing that, I just want to remind you that this webinar can be downloaded through the TAC site, along with some resources that I'll be providing that go along with this webinar. And then each webinar that we have, there'll be some resources that you'll be able to download to support what's discussed at that webinar. I see multiple attendees are typing.
Well, while we're waiting for the multiple attendees to type in, I'm going to post the link to the evaluation so you have it. And again, it'll come via email. But if you could take a few minutes to complete that, we appreciate that.
One of the questions, and this is an issue that is pretty near and dear to my heart, with English as a new language learners in RTI. So thank you for that question. What's the opinion about having first-year ENLs in RTI? I have two eighth-grade boys in math RTI who are first-year ENLs and IFEs. So I guess my answer to that is, if I were, you know, I always think of, in fact, I was a high school student who I became bilingual by my having my senior year in Mexico. And I really needed tier two and tier three. It was an extremely difficult year for me, not because I was a struggling learner. I was pretty good in English. But having, if I had had some support through some of the RTI supports, tiered supports, it would have been very, very helpful to me. And so I think about ENLs coming in and the kinds of supports that they require. I think RTI can be a tremendous benefit for ENLs. And understanding, do they have weaknesses in their native language? So doing some assessments in those areas. And there are assessments available through FastBridge, AmesWeb, there's Spanish anyway, which is 80% of our ENLs. But really, I do believe that supports can be very, very helpful. RTI can support ENLs, but you have to have a different attribution about them. And so it's not that this is a student with a disability that we're looking at, and I don't think anybody in Tier 2 or most students in Tier 2 and Tier 3 aren't looked at that way. We're really looking at supporting them. So I do think that that smaller group intensive targeted instruction helps ELLs. I think there, I will say this, on the other side, I think there is a fear by some people that when an ELL goes into Tier 2 and Tier 3, they're at risk for being referred for a special ed evaluation. And I think just the opposite. We really want to provide those supports in a timely way to prevent them from some ongoing struggles. But excellent question. I really appreciate that. I certainly feel like I needed to learn some Spanish quickly, yes. It does help. Anybody else, I'd be happy to get an email concerning any of these issues too. My email is sethfaldrich@gmail.com. If there were specific questions that you wanted to email with me, I'd be happy to address those.
Great. Thank you so much, Seth, for an informative session. And if you can stay on for a few minutes, I'd appreciate it.
Of course.